To Ecclesiastes 7:11. As we continue our study, if you're visiting with us, if you're joining us already in progress, we've been following Solomon as he searches for meaning, for purpose, for consistency or stability in a chaotic universe. He's looking for something to anchor to in science, in nature, in philosophy, in pleasure or possessions. He's even checked out religion. And as we continue in verse 11, he comes back once again to wisdom. Is it possible I was right the first time? Is it possible that I've been going about this all wrong? Is it possible that wisdom was the right answer all along? If I ponder enough and study enough and reason enough, can I somehow make sense of it all? After all, verse 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. You know, it's not unusual in the face of a hard problem, confronted with a difficult situation, it's not unusual to see someone circle back to what's worked for them before. You see this in sports. The great shooters in basketball shoot when they're hot, and when they're not hot, they shoot till they get hot. They stick with what's got them that far. We see it in business. When I was in business years and years ago, I did a lot of work with the Mars companies, M&M Mars. Have you noticed M&M's works? So they keep putting different stuff in the middle of them. Pretzel M&M's, caramel M&M's, coconut M&M's, Snickers. You got almond Snickers, and you've got, they call them line extensions. And I asked one of the Mars family once upon a time, why is this your strategy? Why not new and innovative products? Why always with the line extensions? And he looked at me and he said, "You danced with the girl, what brung you?" And of course, many great teams, players, businesses fail, don't they? Because they don't recognize that what got you here might not get you there. Swiss watchmakers. A century ago, there were hundreds of Swiss watchmakers. Now you can count them on one hand. They didn't change with the time. Solomon realized that maybe what got me this far won't get me where I need to go. So after exploring wisdom early on, wisdom which was always his strong suit, right? He's realized, well, maybe there's limitations to what I can understand and discern with wisdom. So he moves on. He did what a lot of us do. If our strong suit isn't working, well, the answer must lie in our weakest suit. It must be my worst thing. That's why I haven't figured it out yet, because it's in the thing that I don't like and that I'm not very good at. I worked for somebody for several years who was a big picture guy and good at it. He was a visionary. He was tremendous at casting vision and inspiring people on big ideas. But from time to time, he'd all of a sudden say, "I want to see the numbers. Show me the spreadsheet. Show me the raw data that you got the spreadsheet from. Show me the process that you used to build the spreadsheet." It was frustrating for everyone because he wasn't a numbers guy. He wasn't a quantitative guy even a little bit. He wasn't a detail guy of any kind. But when doing what he was good at didn't work, he tried to do the thing he was horrible at. Now, Solomon wasn't necessarily horrible at science or philosophy. He wasn't necessarily bad at building projects or acquiring things. He was probably pretty good at all of it. He certainly had the time and money to dedicate to those things. But having failed to find what he was looking for, first in wisdom and then in any of these other areas, now he's coming back. Maybe I was right the first time. Maybe it's been wisdom all along. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, verse 11. Better translation is probably wisdom is good as an inheritance. If you've got to get an inheritance, getting wisdom would be something good to get from your parents. You could also render this wisdom is as good as an inheritance. They all kind of work. They all take us to the idea, if you've got to choose between money and wisdom, take wisdom every time. For wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. He's saying they both offer a measure of protection, security, wisdom, money. They both can keep the craziness at bay. But wisdom offers more. Verse 12, the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it. You can lose money. Even if you keep all of your possessions, houses can lose value. Stocks, bonds, the market for those things can plummet. Can't lose wisdom. Once you've got it, it's there. If you have wisdom, worldly wisdom, you've got it. And not only that, but you can always use it to get money. But all the money in the world doesn't necessarily get you wisdom. If you know that wisdom is putting time to proper use, that's Thomas Watson. If you know that wisdom is anticipation, that's Herbert Hoover. If you know that wisdom is determination, Napoleon. If you have all of that kind of worldly wisdom, chances are money will follow. The problem, Solomon continues in verse 13, isn't choosing between money and wisdom. At least it shouldn't be the problem. That choice is easy. The problem is even if we choose wisdom, it's not going to be enough. All the wisdom in the world, Solomon has found, wisest man ever, isn't enough. Why? Because God always wins in the end. No matter how wise we are, God's still calling the shots. Verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? Solomon's reminding us, real power, real control, real prosperity doesn't come from wisdom. Ultimately, it comes from God. What do we want wisdom for, or money, if we choose what's behind door number two and we say, well, I'll take money as my inheritance. Either way, what are we trying to get? We want to be in charge of what happens next, don't we? We want to be in charge of what happens and what doesn't happen in our lives. And the problem Solomon is telling us is that we just can't. Pain, injustice, mistreatment, misfortune, poverty, sadness, sickness, it's in God's hands. Some of you follow Pottersfield, Pastor Mike Rozelle, who came and did the, he's done it a couple times in recent years, the pottery demonstration sharing the gospel. And the first time he was here, he brought a number of his interns with him, the Ignite program that actually one of our own, Amanda Matlock, is going to be being a part of this coming year. Well, a number of their interns were on their way to Calvary Chapel, Philly, where Pastor Mike was going to be speaking this weekend at a men's conference, and they were driving the Mudman food truck. They have a food business, a burger business. They have several restaurants in Montana where they're based, and they have a couple food trucks. They were driving one of their food trucks to Philadelphia. They pulled over to the side of the Ohio Turnpike, and bam, a semi plows into them. And if you look at the photographs on social media, it's the truck did not survive. All of the interns, all of the guys are okay. Praise God is right, yeah. But in a fair and just world, you've got a bunch of young people, a bunch of teens, 20-somethings, who have given a year of their life to serve the Lord here in the U.S. and eventually overseas as part of the program. Young people who have given their lives, they're saying, I'm going to put my life on hold. I'm just going to serve Jesus for a year. And they almost die on the Ohio Turnpike. That's Solomon's point. Is there's no predicting how things are going to work, even for people who are trying to get it right. So what do you do? Verse 14, in the day of prosperity, be joyful. But in the day of adversity, consider, surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that'll come after him. Even serving the Lord. How many of us have bargained, Lord, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. Or we even pay it forward. God, I'm going to do this for you in the hopes that you'll do that for me. And Solomon says, yeah, you can try, but it doesn't work that way. God has a way of doing what he wants to do when he wants to do it. He doesn't yield his sovereignty. He ordains the things that seem good and the things that seem bad in our lives, prosperity and adversity. And in fact, he does it so much so, we don't always know which we're experiencing in the moment that we're experiencing it. Is what's happening to me right now good or bad? We're not always equipped to perceive it. Have I used the Max Lucado illustration with you guys? I couldn't remember. I'll do it again. And that way, if you haven't heard it, you get to hear it. And if you've heard it already, you'll hear it again because it's really good. The old man lives in a tiny village and he's dirt poor. The only thing that he has to call his own is a horse, and it's a beautiful horse. In fact, it's the envy of everyone for miles around. Even the king has offered to buy this horse, but the man refuses because it's not just a horse to him, it's a friend. It's not a possession, it's part of his family. So he's poor and the temptation is always there, but he doesn't sell the horse. Well, one day he finds that the horse is not in the stable. He goes out to groom his horse, to feed his horse. The horse is gone. And the people in the village gather around and they say, well, this is bad. You could have sold that horse for a lot of money and you wouldn't have had to worry about where your next meal is coming from. As it is, you're living hand to mouth and now you don't even have the horse. This is bad. This is horrible. The old man says, say not that this is good or bad. Say only that my horse is missing. That's all we know. The rest is just judgment. If I've been cursed or blessed, that's up to God. The people says, well, what do you think? We're fools? Your horse is gone and that's bad. Well, come to find out that after a couple weeks, the horse returns. He hadn't been stolen. He'd run away. But when he came back, he brought with him a dozen wild horses. The people once again gathered around and they said, you were right. That wasn't bad. This is good. Because now you've got the horse that you always had, but you have these dozen horses and you can break them and sell them and you're going to be rich. We thought this was a curse, but it's really a blessing. And the man said, say not that this is good. Say only that now I have more horses than I had before. You're reading one page and you're trying to judge the entire book. Well, maybe the old man is right, they said to one another. But after a few days, the old man's son is trying to break one of these wild horses and he ends up getting trampled and breaks a leg in the process. The people came back and said, you know what? We were right the first time. This is bad. This is bad. Because now you're going to have to care for your son. You're not even going to be able to eke out a living. You can't break those horses yourself. Look what happened to your son. Oh, this is bad. This is all bad. This is nothing but bad. And the old man said, say not that this is bad. Say only that my son is injured. Well, a few weeks go by, and the country goes to war. And the king sends his army to conscript all of the able-bodied men to fight in the war. And they take all of the sons, all of the young men of the village, except the old man's son. He's not useful as a soldier because he's got a broken leg. And the people who are left in the town say to the man, you know what? We had this backwards. This is good. We didn't see it at the time, but your son breaking his leg was good. And the old man says, do you not understand? Say not that this is good or bad. Say only that my son doesn't have to go to war. And that's everything that Solomon is saying in verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Only God knows. God had purpose in having a semi plow into the mudman truck. Do you know? Do I know? We're not equipped to know, but God knows. So what do we do? What can we do? Just throw up our hands like Job did? The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Fair number of philosophers from Socrates to Tolstoy have said, yeah, that is all we can do. That's the most we can do. That's the best we can do. We can know only that we know nothing, says Tolstoy. That is the highest degree of human wisdom. And Solomon actually comes kind of close to that. Verse 15, he says, life defies all attempts to understand it. I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There's a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there's a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. Life is the ultimate contradiction, he's saying. The good die young, the wicked prosper. So maybe the answer isn't wisdom, Solomon is reluctantly concluding. Maybe the best thing to do is to stop trying to puzzle out, reason through. Maybe the best thing is to give up thinking reason and wisdom are the answers. Verse 16, maybe the answer is don't be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Don't be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? Now here's where we need to be careful, because it sounds like Solomon is saying, stop trying to figure life out. Stop trying to be wise. But don't be wicked either. Just live kind of in the middle. You know, moderation is the key here. Not too sinful, not too righteous. Just drive down the middle of the road. I don't think so. And I don't think that's what he's saying because commentators with better Hebrew than me, which is to say any, tell me that the gist of what Solomon is saying would be like if we said to each other, now don't go being all righteous. Don't go being all wise. Don't try to set the standard. Don't think that you're all that. Don't try to be the example. Don't try to hold yourself up as the example. It's not going to get you anywhere. I mean, not anywhere you want to go, at least. There's nothing to be gained by that, Solomon is exhorting us. Setting ourselves up as the standard of righteousness, telling people, hey, I've got it all figured out, that only I know what righteousness is. Listen to me, because I'll tell you. Don't do that, Solomon is telling us, because we don't know what righteousness is. We don't know what wisdom is in every situation. And the more confident we are that we're right, the more certain Solomon is that we're going to be wrong. And the reason he's confident is because he's tried it. He's telling us, hey, I'm wiser than you, and I've tried to be the one who's right. Verse 16, it's a path that leads to destruction. And we don't have to look very hard to see that Solomon knows what he's talking about. There's abundant examples and evidence all around us, isn't there? How many people, how many groups, how many causes and crusades do you know that are trying to tell you every day, if you don't agree with me, you hate me. I know what's good and right and true, and if you don't agree with me, well, you're a monster, a murderer, Hitler. The tragic thing is when that happens in the church, because it does. Ann and I have a friend, if we live in the Bible Belt here in Wichita, she lives in the buckle. And the church her family attends, not her immediate family, but her extended family, is a church that hates the homosexual, hates the Muslim, and if you don't, you're probably not saved. Because hey, Jacob I've loved and Esau I've hated. God creates people that he hates. He creates people who are created purely to stoke the fires of hell. That's the rhetoric of the Pharisees, in case you don't recognize it. Muslim isn't our enemy. The Muslim is a victim of the enemy. Well, they made themselves enemies of Jesus when they aligned themselves with Satan. Okay, what did Jesus tell us about that? Love our enemies. If we stop, if our conversation begins and ends with we're right and you're wrong, agree with me or I hate you, we're using the tactics of the enemy. And verse 16, we're liable to end up destroying ourselves. If we don't show ourselves to be different than the world, why should anyone in the world listen to us? And why should God continue to use us? Came across a quote this week looking for something else. John Wooden was a believer and coach of the UCLA basketball team for many, many years. Said, talent is God-given, be humble. Fame is man-given, be grateful. Conceit is self-given, be careful. It's good that you grasp this, Solomon says in verse 18. It's good to realize that self-righteousness, conceit, whatever we want to call it, it's a trap. Don't put yourself up on a pedestal, he's warning us. And don't try to run away to the wilderness to escape it all, still verse 18. Remove not your hand from the other. It's Solomon's way of saying, stay in community. Don't think that you can leave all of the degradation of humanity behind. Wherever you go, there you are. It's he who fears God who will escape them all. He who fears God will escape the snare of self-righteousness. He who fears God will escape the destruction that follows. God? God? I thought Solomon was dead set on keeping God outside this investigation. I thought he was all about look for meaning under the sun, in the natural world. He was. And he did. And he failed. So he's finally coming around to considering the opposite. He's acknowledging that he might have to reference something, someone outside this world. Not just to find meaning, but to keep from losing his mind. Trying to sort out the mysteries of prosperity or adversity, he's realizing he might have to resort to divinity. Wisdom's got a place. Solomon's not ready to kick wisdom to the curb. Wisdom is greater than money. He's already told us that. Verse 19, he tells us wisdom is greater than the military. Wisdom strengthens the wise more than 10 rulers of the city. And wisdom can even be illuminating. Verse 20, wisdom can show us there's not a just man on earth who does good and does not sin. You and I know that by divine revelation. You and I read Romans 3, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You and I read Isaiah 53, we all like sheep have gone astray. But wisdom can show us those things as well. If we're paying attention, we can discern those things through wisdom. I dropped out of grad school as an unbeliever, largely because graduate psychology was trying to tell me that humanity has an innate drive towards goodness and wholeness and integrity. And I said, okay, but what about all of human history? What about looking at children in their infancy? No drive to goodness there. That's when I knew that psychology was rotting from the inside out. Wisdom told me that. Wisdom has its uses. Wisdom can show us that we all sin. Wisdom can also show us that people aren't the answer to our problems. Verse 21, do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. Pleasing people isn't the answer, Solomon tells us. If we're wise, we'll realize we can't. If we're really wise, we won't even try. Because inevitably, we'll disappoint people just as many times they've disappointed us. Many times, we're going to be listening, looking, searching, seeking, wanting, needing the praise of man. And we're going to be left with a handful of hate. Just as many times, people have done their best to love us, bless us, serve us, and they've got nothing but anger and frustration from us. If you're wise, Solomon says, don't go down that road. It's a dead end. It's a cul-de-sac. Because if we're not wise, if we decide our measure of success is other people's opinions, we're going to live our whole lives trying to take a pulse, checking the polls, reading the returns, and we're going to get wrecked. Spurgeon, in his book, Lectures to My Students, collection of just that, lectures that he gave people going into ministry. Among the best is a lecture called One Blind Eye and One Deaf Ear. He told his students, you know what, you need to decide ahead of time that you're going to turn a deaf ear to the praise of men. Because if you start wanting, needing, looking for the praise of men, if that's what your criteria for success is, if you tune your heart that way, when the criticism comes, and it will, it'll crush you. Back to wisdom, Solomon is saying, hey, wisdom can give us some things, but it still leaves us stuck. Wisdom can show us that we need an answer, verse 20. Wisdom can show us that people aren't the answer, verse 21. Verse 23, wisdom is incapable of showing us what is the answer. Because if wisdom had the answer, Solomon would have found it. He's tried, verse 23, all this I've proved by wisdom. I said, I'll be wise. And I thought, and I thought, and I thought, and I thought, and I thought. But it was still far from me. And he's getting ready to conclude, that's because it's far from everybody. Verse 24, as for that which is far off and exceedingly deep, who can find it out? Because the harder he tried, the more enigmatic and mysterious it became. You ever study something like that, where the more you stared at it, the cloudier it got? I was reading ahead this week, looking at Jesus in Gethsemane, studying ahead for our Life of Christ study on Sundays. Man, the more I study Gethsemane, the less I understand. Things have got to like that sometimes. And that's what Solomon is running into. Verse 25, I applied my heart to know, to search and seek out and wisdom and the reason of things, to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness. Why are people the way they are? He wanted to know. Why is life the way it is? Why is evil attractive? Why is contentment elusive? And we know why Solomon's frustrated, because for us, it's like watching a suspense movie, right? We know who the killer is before the main character has figured it out. It's your partner's girlfriend. Don't trust her. And we're watching Solomon. Solomon, you're looking in the world. You're never going to find it. But we see in this chapter, he's starting to figure it out. Where was she when he was killed? Think about it. And as Solomon relates this journey to us, we keep saying, it's Jesus. Can't you see, man? He's getting there. He's describing this to us chronologically, and he's saying, here's where I started, and here's what I did next, and here's what I did after that. And we can see he's just on the verge of, I think. He's gotten to the point where he's beginning to suspect all the wisdom in the world can't explain fully the condition of the world. All the wisdom in the world can't explain the condition of man's heart in the world. He's realizing you can't learn how to not get cancer by smoking cigarettes. You can't learn how to not get fat by eating Coke and Twinkies. He's figuring out the answer to the problems of the world aren't going to come from the world. And we know from our conversations on Sundays, when humanity thinks it's finally found the supreme answer to all of its problems in the world, that's going to be its undoing, because his name will be Antichrist. Solomon, by the end of chapter 7, he's put 2 and 2 together. And he's ready to warn us off. He's ready to tell us the solutions to the problems of the world, the answer to what we're seeking in this world isn't in the world. And we shouldn't listen to the world when the world tries to tell us different, because the world is a seductress. Verse 26, I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets, whose hands are fetters. Woman here is a metaphor for the world. That's a trope that we're familiar with from Proverbs. Woman is a stand-in, is a placeholder for the world. Snares and nets and fetters, that's money and mansions and studies and philosophies and experiences and investigations. And it's a trap, Solomon is warning us. The world, with all of its pleasures and puzzles, is trying to suck us in, trying to distract us from noticing that the world's defining quality is what? Emptiness. Don't get sucked in, he's saying. I've done my homework, he's telling us. Here's what I'm ready to share with you. He who pleases God shall escape from her. Please God, you'll escape the snares of the world. But the sinner will be trapped by her. Solomon, dude, you're getting awfully spiritual here. Yeah. Because all of the investigation of the last 7 chapters, how long did that take him? Years, it had to be, just from the building projects that he described. Decades, maybe. And it yielded nothing but disappointment after disappointment. He's ready to move on. Because besides everything else, he hasn't even consistently found the comfort of feeling like he's not alone in the battle. Even feeling like he's got somebody who's with him in this journey is sadly, painfully elusive. Here's what I found, says the preacher, verse 27. Adding one thing to the other to find out the reason which my soul still seeks, but I cannot find. The encouragement of having a real ally in this cold, cruel world. Yeah, not so much. A friend, not likely, he's discovered. One man among 1,000 I've found, but a woman among all of these I've not found. Which, by the way, isn't a commentary on women. Solomon wrote some of the highest praise of women found anywhere in Scripture, found anywhere in ancient writing. He wrote Proverbs 80, wrote Proverbs 31. Well, that's what he figured out later. When he wrote this, he was a chauvinist pig. Maybe. I think he's telling us something else. I think that he's telling us what he figured out later was that sex was as empty as anything else in the world. Sex outside of marriage, one big blind alley. When he says, I haven't found one woman out of a thousand, I don't think that thousand is a random number. Because what do we know Solomon had? He had 1,000 sex partners. He had 300 wives and 700 concubines. And none of them was a true ally. None of them was a true friend, a true partner. Because all of them, the relationship started in the boardroom or in the bedroom. It either started as a means to a political alliance, or it started as pursuit of pleasure. Neither one got Solomon what he was looking for. Political alliances don't bring inner peace. And the best sexual partner won't bring meaning and purpose to an empty world. He said, yeah, I tried woman after woman, thinking that sex would bring us closer. And all it did was help him realize, no, it's a rare person who adds and doesn't subtract in bed or out of bed. The reality is the more we need someone to be that friend, that partner, that companion, that you and me against the world person, paradoxically, the more certain we are to be disappointed. The more we need someone to be that, the more likely we are to be disappointed. How so? No one in this world can fill our emptiness. And the more someone tries to do that, the more they're going to prove they can't. And the more we try to do that for someone else, the more we prove that we can't. The worst is when two people try to do that for each other at the same time. Nothing more tragic than watching two people try to be one another's saviors, doing more and more, giving up more and more, trying harder and harder, in the process, satisfying each other less and less, probably. I've been there. In the long run, it breeds resentment. Because two people both feel like, well, I'm trying harder than you. You must not be trying, because if we were both trying as hard as we can try, we'd be satisfied. We'd be fulfilled. We would have found peace by now. Meanwhile, they're both sacrificing everything. It's a spiral straight to bitterness. Because there are few things more painful, few things more disappointing than thinking you found the person in this world who's going to complete you, only to find out how painfully wrong you've been. And even when you find someone, because Solomon did, not a woman, not a soulmate, but he found among some guys, there was one in 1,000 who was a friend, an ally, a teammate, a partner in crime. Dad probably told him about the relationship he had with Jonathan. It still didn't make anything better. Still didn't solve the problem. Still didn't infuse his life with meaning and purpose. It just made the emptiness a little less lonely. So friendship, even real friendship, as rare as it is in this world, isn't the answer. What's the answer, Solomon? Verse 29, truly this only I have found, that God makes man upright. They've sought out many schemes. The thing we're looking for, the missing link we're seeking, the quality we're lacking, looking outside of us, looking within us, looking for through experience, thinking through theories, we have to realize the whole reason we're searching in the first place is we've fallen from what God intended us to be. He made us upright, Solomon says. That's how humanity began. He made us in his own image. He made us moral. He made us righteous. He made us perfect. And we corrupted it. And we can try by many schemes, he says, verse 29. We can try by hook or by crook to restore what we've lost or to ignore the fact that it's missing. But only God can fix what's happened to us, what we did to us. Only he can fill what's lacking in us. Which is why God ordains the universe the way that he does. The question that Solomon asks back in 13, verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he's made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. Solomon says this is the way it is, but he doesn't answer the question why. Why does God allow us to dwell in a universe that doesn't have clear cause and effect? Israel at least had God's promise that if they obeyed God, he'd bless them, and if they disobeyed God, he'd curse them. Why isn't that all of us? Why doesn't that everyone all of the time? Why is it that so many times good seems to be punished and evil seems to be rewarded? I mean, yeah, in the long run, God balances the scales. But why in the short run does it seem so backward so often? Why do we have to wait? God in his mercy is making it harder for us to deceive ourselves. God in his mercy is making it more difficult for us to believe for any length of time that we have any control whatsoever. Satan's great and recurring lie is that we can be like gods. He's been pitching that one ever since the garden, and he keeps pitching it because it keeps working. We can be like gods. We can be our own gods. We can understand. If we understand, we can plan. If we plan, we can control. If we can control, we can prosper. God loves us way too much to let that work. God retains control in a way that makes it clear he has it and that we don't. Because if we think we have control, we're going to understand and plan and prosper ourselves right into the ground because we don't know what's best. We don't see the big picture. But if we think we do even a little bit, that's enough for us to box God right out of our lives, and we've all done it, haven't we? It's God's mercy that leads him to allow us to live in a world. He didn't make it this way. We made it this way. But God leaves it this way in his mercy so that we don't know what's going to happen next. Even on this side of the cross, even as children of God, God does the kindest, most loving thing he could possibly do to push us to acknowledge we need him. We need him. The safest, best, most peaceful, most prosperous place we could be is surrendered to him. Life has to be hard, or we'll never get there. Do you know that tonight? Have you surrendered to that? Have you made your peace with that? That no matter what you do, this life is going to happen. It's not always going to make sense. Won't always be fun. Sometimes it will hurt. Even if you do everything right, and you won't always do everything right. We've got two choices, Solomon concludes. By the end of the chapter, Solomon says two options. We can go crazy trying to fight it, or we can find peace in accepting it. God does love us, and everything that happens to us happens because he allows it. Everything that happens to us is father-filtered. We don't necessarily understand it this side of heaven. I don't know that we ever completely understand why the things in this life unfold the way that they do. But we've got two choices. Solomon, who set out to find meaning in this life without God, says at the end of the study, at the end of the research, at the end of the investigation, there's two choices. We can keep trying, or we can try trusting. Lord, I pray for your mercy, because we are stubborn. I am. We're willful. And we have this inordinate capacity to avoid and ignore lessons that we don't like. Lord, I pray your mercy as you break us, because you will. You're going to bring every one of us to a point of crying out that we need you. And even having submitted and surrendered to you for salvation, Lord, you're going to keep pressing. You're going to keep pushing until we acknowledge we need you not only for eternity, but we need you for today. We need you this hour. We need you for this choice. We need you in this relationship. We need you in this ministry. We need you in this work day, in this workplace. We need you with our neighbor. We need you at school. Lord, there's nowhere where we don't need you. And there's nowhere that we shouldn't trust you. You know the end from the beginning. You see the big picture. You know how everything fits together to serve you, to glorify you. Lord, bring us to a place of accepting that and surrendering to it and being willing participants, eager participants in your plan. And Lord, we know that we're going to fight back. But again, we pray your mercy, Lord. Show us, remind us, bring us back to the place that we need to be as gently as possible while still getting us there, because we want to be there, Lord. Our best selves want to be there. We give you permission. We ask you, bring us there.